This is a Relay Project.
The Discourse starts right now with Cheryl Oates and Erica Baroudes.
Welcome back to The Discourse. Today, we're talking leadership race strategies, why candidates enter, and what it takes to win. And we are pleased that NDP leadership candidate Sarah Hoffman will be joining The Discourse today.
And I've said it on many episodes that I kind of pride myself as an expert, given I'm an Alberta conservative and have gone through this process more times than I can count.
Well, I mean, we're lucky to have a resident expert on the show. The Alberta Conservatives,
thank you, Cheryl.
In some form or another, have had 5 leaders over the last 10 years. That's not counting interim leaders, because there's been a couple of those as well. But since we have all of this resident expertise on our show, let's take a look back at leadership campaigns and leadership strategies and use some of those campaigns that you've been a part of or been privy to, Erica, over the years as reference cases.
Well, I'm definitely ready to start the episode with my area of expertise. But before that, let's thank our sponsors. So California Closet, as someone that, you know, didn't have a family till later in life, I never really appreciated the kitchen pantry until now. And with California Closets, it definitely makes mealtime a lot easier. And a well-designed pantry can bring out the chef in everyone. I think my husband may beg to differ on that one about me, but, you know, we can always try it out. User-friendly kitchen storage is a staple ingredient when it comes to preparing meals and being prepared. Shelving, drawers, and baskets combined to accommodate specific needs and uses. Ensure easy access and a sense of order in a space where items are continually required, removed, and replaced. So with that, Cheryl, let's get into the many reasons, actually, I think, why people actually enter leadership races and what's their motivation to become leader.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's one obvious reason that people enter leadership races. Obviously, there are those who want to become the leader of a party. But I think what's overlooked, if you're not sort of sitting on the inside of leadership races or paying that close attention to politics, is all the other reasons that people enter leadership races. And it could be that they, of course, want to lead the party. It could be that they want to build their own profile. Maybe they're a long shot candidate that doesn't really have a chance of winning, doesn't really have a chance of pulling enough vote to be a top candidate, but building their profile over the course of the race is really important to them. There's, of course, those that want to gain influence or stature in the party. You know, you want to be one of the people, the movers and shakers. This is a good way to build your platform. There are those that, of course, want to forward a specific cause. I think one of the examples we've seen in the race that's going on with the NDP right now is Jodi Callaghan Stonehouse. Protecting water is really important to her. And she's forwarded that issue. She's kind of made it a core piece of her campaign. Despite the fact that she's a long shot candidate, she's, you know, getting a lot of people talking about it. And I think that's one of her reasons for entering.
Yeah, you definitely see, and from my experience, sometimes it is actually frustration with the current leader or frustration with the direction of your party, and you believe that you're the best candidate. And that can go for the people that, you know, don't have it's a long shot for them to win or a hope in hell of winning. And the people that are, you know, those front runners. And so in this case with the NDP, like, it was a very peaceful time. The leader is staying in their place and chose that timing. So I think there's a little bit more friendliness in the tone of this leadership race. But one of the big things I always look for, and especially because of how the NDP leadership race came to be, is how are you going to be different than the leader? And that's something I think, regardless of if you're in it to win it, or you're just there because you want to have some opportunities to do a bunch of interviews to either push your issues or make a name for yourself. We saw that in the last UCP leadership race, and we will see it in this NDP leadership race. And I think that that's a consistent in some of the strategies that the candidates will play.
And then, like, I think there's a couple really unique reasons to join a race, and we've seen some of them in the Conservatives over the years in Alberta. One, whether you believe this was the case or not, is to come in as a kamikaze candidate.
Oh my goodness. Basically, I was hoping that I thought that word was like one we don't use. I was kidding. Well, we don't anymore now because the RCMP investigation's done.
The RCMP did investigate, but this was basically an allegation that Jeff Calloway had entered the UCP race basically to run against one of Jason Kenney's opponents, build support against one of Jason Kenney's opponents, then drop out and endorse Jason Kenney. So basically he's there as a dark horse for Jason Kenney, doing the work of Jason Kenney, maybe getting the blood on his hands so that Jason Kenney doesn't have to, and then eventually dropping out and he's not actually a candidate. Now, as we said, the RCMP have investigated and no charges have been laid, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's not what happened here.
Well, I stand by the RCMP's investigation. And to be honest, like that was kind of like this elephant in the room for the party for a long time. Like we're talking 2017 and this just ended. And so it does impact both, I mean, the brand and the focus of the party, because you've always got something else looming. I'm very happy that what was said in 2017 is now proven in 2024, that there was none of that type of source. But you know what it actually also does, and something that I think the NDP candidates need to be conscious of while they go through this, is like that can burn a lot of bridges within the party and can create a lot of chaos. I mean, your chaos is, do you like a carbon tax or not, or do you support the federal party or not? And like, that's clearly not at the same level as, you know, the allegations and the legal actions that were taken with Jeff Calloway, and kind of just like, to be honest, didn't help the UCP start on that fresh foot that they were trying to, and it just became again an elephant in the room. So, you know, there's the strategy of, you know, the opponents or others pointing fingers, saying something like that happens to try and gain it, but it also does have an impact on the party and the party brand, which took a long time to work through. And, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of relief when that came through. Not that I think there was any doubt, but it was something that's just dragged through our party since inception.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, by the time it had actually been resolved, Jason Kenney is no longer the leader, and it's far less relevant than it was when the allegations first came out. The other reason for entering a race that I wanted to raise, because it may be the most interesting and perhaps worth talking about in the NDP leadership as well, is running for the leadership of a party with the sole goal of dismantling or changing the role of the current party. And we saw this with Jason Kenney when he ran to be the leader of the Progressive Conservatives with the platform of basically dismantling the party and uniting it with the other conservative party, the Wild Rose, into a united conservative party. That is a pretty unique platform to run for leadership of a party on.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I think a lot of people were surprised that Jason Kenney would fit under the progressive conservative branch, but it did give the best path in his, you know, 5-point plan to creating a new party and, you know, getting back into government. And so, you know, you see this path of who you are, what you're doing. Like it seems kind of weird to people. And you did see the other side of individuals that ran against Jason Kenney, including Doug Schweitzer, that didn't want the parties to merge or weren't sure how or when they were going to merge. So you're basically saying like, pick me to be your, so I can dissolve this thing and bring the two parties together. Obviously there was support of the grassroots members to do so. And that's why I think Jason Kenney was so successful, but it is a weird the concept that you're like, I want to disband this. So vote for me.
And I mean, typically, especially if a party has historically been successful, it's really hard to do that. Like, I can't imagine other circumstances where what Jason Kenney, I mean, props to Jason Kenney, that is a huge accomplishment to be able to run for leader and then unite two parties. But in normal circumstances, if a party has been incredibly successful or enjoyed some success, the membership and the membership are happy. They want to see that success continue. And so that's why a lot of the conversation around the NDP leadership has been, you know, the NDP is not looking for someone to come in and save it. The NDP has been, you know, pretty successful over the last decade and grown a lot. It's looking for someone to continue the work that has already been done. And so when people come in and say, you know, I'm coming in to save the party, or I'm coming in to take it over, I'm coming in and to take it in a different direction, I think in this case, you'd see the NDP push back on that.
But you know what's interesting? I mean, I don't think it's as extreme of changing the membership or changing the direction of the party, but we do have a lot of candidates that come from very opposite sides of your party running, right? Like we have a strategy, and I know we'll talk to Sarah Hoffman about this, is like she's kind of the true New Democrat candidate that like the membership is, you know, more her type of people. where you have other candidates that are trying to expand the party, and that always needs to happen, but they seem to be doing it to the center as opposed to maybe the far left. And so, yes, that does happen, but or it doesn't, it's not because someone has to save the party, but you also see Nahed Nenshi kind of get painted with that brush. So I agree with you that it's not as extreme as dismantling, but we even saw this with, you know, when Danielle Smith ran, the party membership did change to some degree. And I think that even with her becoming the leader, there was a very big effort to still appeal to more, the more centrist or, you know, the former PCs that maybe didn't see that home. And so you do shift like by the leader and who takes the reins, the party membership or the values and beliefs will change.
Yeah. And some of that comes from the evolution of Alberta, right? Evolution of Alberta and Alberta politics is like when you were the Progressive Conservatives, you were, and your official opposition was the Wild Rose, you were talking to a very specific portion of conservatives in Alberta. And now Danielle Smith has had to sort of expand the way that she talks, hoping to, you know, hold the progressives and also hold those who sit further right than maybe the Progressive Conservatives had. And it's the same with the New Democrats. I mean, when you're the fourth party, you're trying to get your coalition and your base to speak up and be loud and make noise. And then you become government and you're governing for all Albertans and your job is to expand the tent. And that's the job of any political party in Alberta is how do you keep your base, but how do you bring enough people along with you along the way to keep their votes and stay in government? So it'll be interesting to hear from Sarah Hoffman about how she sees how the party has moved over the last decade and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
And where she wants to take it, right? Like there might be some values and beliefs that have been kind of like put to the wayside along the way. And so I do want to get into that when we start asking your questions. But I think another thing, and you kind of alluded to it when you started talking about this, and interested to hear your perspective, especially from the last leadership race, is actually the people that, I mean, they may think they're going to win, but you can kind of see, especially by the time that you start the first debates, you see the numbers coming in and it's like, they're going to need 7 Hail Marys in the last couple of weeks to actually, you know, gain any traction that they're not the first few to drop off. And you said a specific issue, and I think Jody is a great example of that. Like, you know, what is she hoping for? Is she vying for the Minister of Environment? Should they ever form power? And there are different strategies when you're in government versus opposition, right? Because you have that runway till the next election. So your carrot or your chips that you can use may not be as long lasting as your leader becoming the premier. I think the other interesting thing is actually like people that are doing it to have a stance in the party or to gain influence. And I want to get your thoughts on this because the first person when I was thinking about that was Todd Lowen. And remember when Todd Lowen ran and he was actually outside of the party. He, you know, had left the caucus, was an independent. And this was him actually, I think, less running for leader, even though I think he had a decent chance and he didn't end, you know, poorly in the rankings. But it was more like, I believe in this party. I'm going to travel the province. I'm going to like build street cred with all of our members to show that I want to be back on the team. And I think, I mean, it's a very expensive and exhausting way to do it. But I think there was, you know, a few issues he talked about, especially around COVID. But primarily, I think he was doing it to get back in the good books. And frankly, I mean, he's now a minister, so it didn't work out too poorly from him to be very much on the outsides under the Kenney administration and then come back in to be a minister under Premier Danielle Smith.
For sure. And that's a great way to not only build your own profile and build your own following inside the party, but also just to demonstrate your credibility, to demonstrate your ability to politic. I think especially when you have large caucuses, it's easy to get overlooked. It's easy for, you know, backbenchers, if you're government or newer MLAs, to not have their skills and influence and communications ability recognized. And when you put it on a stage, like a leadership, it's really hard for the front runners not to pay attention. And when one of them is ultimately successful, they're going to remember, okay, that person has some skill and I want them on my team. And I think for those who aren't necessarily in the running to be successful, even just building that credibility and demonstrating what you're capable of is really valuable.
Okay, so let's dig into that, because we talked about like the obvious front runner. I want to lead the party. I have a vision for the province and for our membership. So I want to be that person, and I actually have a darn good chance of doing it. And I think in this leadership race, we've kind of like mentioned those two. And if people are still confused, I'd say like Nahed Nenshi and Sarah Hoffman are the first two that come to mind. But I think like Kathleen Ganley is, you know, pretty close in there. And with Racky dropping out, it actually gives her more opportunity. So you've got this like group, and then you've got these other two candidates with Jody and Gil, and it's like, so what is your goal? Like, are you running to gain profile within the party? Are you running to, again, like, what's your intention and what would be success for you? And I always wonder that, especially like I think back to a lot of the Conservative Party of Canada leadership, where there was like everyone and their dog running. And so it's like, do you want to finish top? Do you want to like gain some traction where you started as the caboose and you moved up one or two spots? You weren't like, it might be like you're not the first to drop off. And so like, what are you seeing from or hearing from the membership that's like, am I accurate as my outsider perspective? Or do you think it's a fair chance for everyone? And do you think everyone's actually in it to win it?
I think everyone joined the race to win it. I think there are those who probably think it would be a bit of a long shot for them, but I think they entered hoping to win. In addition to Sarah and Nahed, I do think that Kathleen Ganley is still in a front running position. I know that that team is selling thousands of memberships. So I think between the three of them, they have sort of positioned themselves as front runners. And there are those out there who haven't made up their minds that are really, you know, considering the three of them. I think that Gil and Jody are sort of seen as the candidates with a bit of a long shot. Gil for sure is raising issues that wouldn't necessarily or haven't necessarily been the focal points of the campaign so far. A lot of the talk has been like, who's best placed to beat Danielle Smith and what is the vision of the party? And Gil is really, you know, with his background in labor, reminding people that the roots of the party is working people, the roots of the party is workers' rights. And I think that's a really important addition to the conversation. I do think that's part of his, what he brings to the race. And then Jody, like we said, she's talked about water protection, but also, you know, the NDP prides itself on being inclusive and diverse and talking about Indigenous rights. And it is so important that we have an Indigenous voice in the race as well. If we're going to say that we're the party that talks about this, let's walk the walk and make sure that we have a prominent Indigenous voice in the race as well. So, I mean, that's great for the party, but I also think that Jody's candidacy on its own is just really a really great addition.
Yeah, and I'm not discrediting anyone that puts their name forward.
For sure.
They obviously have reason, and good for them for going through what is a very different process, like a leadership race. So, I mean, I know you have lots of folks on all of the campaigns. Like, what have you guys learned? And then I want to get into like voter intention, because I think there's a whole different strategy on leadership race of like, what's, you know, the preferential ballot, but also like, do you pick someone for a specific reason? Or what is that reason? But like, what have you guys learned about leadership? Because they're totally different than, I mean, it's a nomination on steroids. And so what are you seeing, and where do you think that some of the lessons learned so far? How have you seen some of the campaigns pivot their strategy? Because I've had a few conversations. I mean, I'm not sharing any any advice necessarily, but there's definitely, I've seen some pivots in the campaign to change focus on how they're campaigning.
Well, it's interesting because the NDP leadership races before this look nothing like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like 2014 was our last leadership. There was less than 4,000 ballots cast. There was three candidates, and it was largely an incredibly friendly race. There wasn't a lot of disagreement. I mean, the party had been working on specific things for a long time. We hadn't had the opportunity to actually implement those things because we hadn't formed government. And so it was, you know, everyone was sort of working on along the same line. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there is consensus in this province that this is at least a two-party, it's a two-party system. There is a real chance that the NDP will be competitive and gunning to form government in the next election. And so there's more of a conversation happening about where the party goes from here. So we formed government, we had 4 years in government, and then we lost the last two elections. What have we done right? What have we done wrong? And how do we build on the success that we've seen so far? And that has led to a whole bunch of different conversations. And you know, you see Sarah Hoffman sort of digging in, saying we need to rely on the things that we're really good at. We need to be unapologetic New Democrats, and we need to not let ourselves be pulled off of our values just for the sake of winning. Mm-hmm. And then you see other people say the future is, one, communication, because Danielle Smith is talented and we need someone who can stand up to her, and two, growing the party to a place where, you know, we're probably closer to the center and we're a bigger tent. And that discussion wasn't happening in 2014, and it certainly wasn't happening before that, but it is guiding the discussion around the leadership now.
Yeah, well, I would definitely say the last one was a coronation for sure for Rachel. I can, you know, I think I mentioned like the Jim Dinning effect of like people think you're going to win, so they don't show up. Maybe that is attributed, or just your voting structure, to the 4,000 people showing up, where I think we're going to see a lot more than that.
For sure.
You know, and a pretty large bench. I mean, Pierre, I think people would also argue, is somewhat of a coronation, although he still GOTV'd or got out the vote to have that mass win. Like, he was 10 votes behind, right? And I mean, there was, what, four other candidates against him. So it wasn't like the majority vote was super likely, but he just, you know, did actually end up getting the momentum I think Rachel had, but because she didn't have as deep of a bench of competitors, it wasn't as hard to get that 50%. So I hope Rachel will love that I just compared her to Pierre Poilievre. But I'm sure she'll send you a note. But then coming back to like why people vote, and this is when, like you said, I think when it was Rachel, it was very much just like, what is your vision for our party? Now it is, what is also your vision for the province, and who's going to be the best suited to go toe-to-toe with Danielle Smith? And so I think even from folks I know that have now bought memberships or are voting for Nahed are coming in being like, he's the one that can beat Danielle Smith. And I think that was also a motivation for Pierre Poilievre, was like, he is the best to go toe-to-toe with Justin Trudeau. So, you know, we've seen a lot of similarities in what people are looking for and how they might potentially vote or what they care about. So what do you think? How's this going to split or break for the different candidates of who's going to compare it to who your competition is versus, I am so true to my values and beliefs that I just want a leader that I feel like reflects me and my version of being a New Democrat?
Yeah, I honestly think it's a bit of both. I think that New Democrats want to win, and we've had a taste of it, and we feel like we came really close in the last election. And so part of the decision for members will be who can win the next election. But at the same time, the NDP is not an organization that is willing to win at all costs. So if that means someone comes in, like if you have the best, most like the best communicator in the province, someone who could easily win a debate against Danielle Smith, but they come in and say, I want to dismantle public health care and I don't care about workers' rights and who cares about climate change, the party is not going to vote for that person. Fundamentally, the party wants someone who believes in New Democrat values, who wants to take the province in that direction, and at the same time can elect a leader that has the communication skill to compete with Danielle Smith, and also the leadership ability to guide the NDP through its next chance at government.
Well, they very well might. And I can, as soon as you said that, I was like thinking of Erin O'Toole, right? That campaigns one way and then pivots another. And that's, I think, something that people should really think about. Like, you know, even for people that have been elected officials before, did they, you know, stand up for their values and beliefs, and did they keep those? Were they challenging caucus, or were they the mayor that you expected them to be, right? And so I think one of the challenges is you can only see as far as the finish line of this race. And so it's going to be interesting, because I'll remind folks, if they don't live in the world of conservative leadership, is like, I think a lot of people supported Erin O'Toole because he was deemed kind of like the middle on social conservative values. And he was also a good contender for Justin Trudeau. There wasn't a lot you could throw at him. So when he became leader, I think there was a lot of people that saw that opportunity. And then during the actual election, he did pivot hard on position of carbon tax or carbon pricing, pivoted on a few things, and that also didn't sit well with his caucus, and ultimately was kind of the demise of him being leader, which got us whole back into another leadership race. But that's also something I think people need to be concerned about, is like, you can say all these things, your record before will also speak to do you just talk from one side of your mouth and then lead by the other?
Yeah, for sure. And I think the other thing to remember when it comes to the Alberta NDP leadership is there's so much campaign left. So for those, you know, that want to say the campaign is over or that people have already decided, that is just absolutely not the case. I think we can all agree Nahed Nenshi had a really rock star start. And, you know, he sold a whole bunch of memberships in those first couple of weeks, and he made national news everywhere, and that raised the profile of his own campaign and also the race. But he has to maintain that momentum straight through now until people cast their ballots and until a leader is announced in June. And between now and then, there's lots of conversations to be had, but there's also formal debates being held by the party. And I think I know for myself, and I know for a lot of people, it's really putting those candidates on the spot and having them compare and contrast their views of the party and what the future looks like for it, but also their positions on specific issues that the membership cares about. And I do think through those debates, there's three of them scheduled, a lot of people won't make up their mind until they've seen them.
Well, yeah. And I think we can both agree that the general election, when we saw this last go, it was a big, as I like to call it, TSN turning point, especially for the UCP, how Danielle Smith performed. And not to say that Rachel actually didn't perform well. I think it was just one person performed better. And I think she put a lot of the, is she, you know, going to be a strong and focused leader? And she showed that in the debate. So I think you're right. Like, the debates do matter. And again, that's why last week when we were talking about Racky, I thought it was such a miss for her career to back out, because I think she would have been like quite a firecracker there, and really raised issues. They are also traps, right? Like, it can get you with a soundbite that, you know, hurts you and all of these things.
It could be the end of your campaign.
Exactly. And actually, speaking of the debate, and I shared this with you earlier, is like, as we talked about a bingo card for the leadership, I figured we should start doing them around the debate. And so what I heard on our phone call is like, you might actually want to create your own, because mine might be snarky, as you call it, when I said, you know, a bingo item is carbon tax good, carbon tax bad. And so you've got to get different leaders to say different things. But to our listeners as well, like, we're all ears. And given there's five debates, we might get to make like a bunch of bingo cards for three. And so these three debates, like, that's a lot of material we can cover on what people will say and maybe won't say. And I mean, hint, I do have Gil mentioning his union. So I think that's a definite one. All right. Well, I'll give you credit, Cheryl. You made some good points on that one. And I look forward to further analyzing the strengths and weaknesses of the leadership candidate campaigns. Speaking of candidates, we have Sarah Hoffman with us today. Before we introduce her, let's throw to a quick clip of her launch kickoff.
Women like me aren't supposed to run for office. I'm fat, I'm sassy, and I am really bad at pretending to be something that I'm not. I grew up in a small town, and I saw firsthand how conservatives harmed the school where my dad was a principal and my mom taught kindergarten. After I trained to be a teacher, conservatives tried to close a bunch of schools in my community. So I ran for the school board, and I won against an incumbent trustee. And then I won again. I ran for the legislature against a conservative cabinet minister, and I won again, and again, and again. I get the job, and I get the job done. And I work my f***ing ass off. Sorry, Mom.
Former Deputy Premier, former Minister of Health, former Edmonton School Board Chair and candidate to become the next leader of the Alberta NDP, Sarah Hoffman, welcome to The Discourse.
Thank you so much for having me on, Cheryl and Erica. I'm really excited to be here.
So maybe just first, let's talk about that video, because what a video, like, what a great launch, what great energy. Tell us about sort of your campaign style and how you decided to do something like that.
Thank you. I want to have a mandate to be myself. And I think if you want to be yourself, you need to tell people who you are. And I think that people are craving authenticity in their leaders. And men on the right get away with it all the time, saying and doing things that are authentically themselves, that I don't think really further opportunities for all of us to be successful. So I think I can be a woman on the left and own who I am and be myself and let people in to know a little bit about my journey and why my values are what they are. And I think often when people get to know you, they find out that their values align with yours too.
Like, I actually loved your video. Not that I will be voting for you or anyone, but I thought it was spicy, and it came out and actually like addressed maybe some things that people were going to criticize or poke at you. Like, you just took the air out of their sails. And so it was a very different, I'll say different from your kickoff rally. And it really, like, I think really kicked off your official campaign with momentum. You mentioned something when you were answering that question of like your true values, and you're kind of identified as the candidate that is like true. You've come out saying we're not going to change who the NDP is. It's true to the roots of who we are. So what does that mean for you as leader? And what does that mean for you as you're also trying to grow the party and sell memberships?
I grew up in a really small town in Northern Alberta that always had a conservative MLA, but our values were NDP values. I just didn't know that at that time. When somebody needed help getting to a doctor's appointment, of course, somebody was going to do a phone tree and figure out who could take them to the doctor that was 50 kilometers away. If somebody needed help getting their crops off the field, people always stepped up and helped each other. And if there were ever openings on the volunteer firefighters, they were filled in a moment. Those to me are NDP values, and they are Alberta values. And I don't think we need to pretend to be something we're not. I think we can own public health care and make sure that we address climate change and make sure that we do more to help people get affordable housing and keep it affordable. And I think that we need to talk about the issues that need NDP values guiding them instead of pretending to be something we're not.
Have you ever not voted NDP? I'm just curious because some of your competitors have. So like where, and you don't have to share that obviously, but was there a time where you weren't this, you know, true orange NDPer?
I found the NDP very quickly after moving to Edmonton. It was definitely the place where I, when I was going to protests against the war in Iraq, there were NDP MLAs there. When I'm going to protest now about Palestine, I'm an NDP MLA. I found my values very quickly. So I've always voted NDP and I'm proud of that.
Sarah, you just to put a finer point on this, because in the rally that you held when you kicked off your campaign, you went right at this, because there are those that, you know, now that the NDP has seen some success, would like to take the party in a bit of a different direction. And you have basically been unapologetic in your values and have sort of stood up and said, I don't want to be a liberal, you know, cloaked as a New Democrat. I want to stand by a New Democrat. Like, are you worried that there are some people out there, you know, including your colleagues running for leader, that want to take the party away from its roots?
Well, I think there's some people running who don't even refer themselves now as New Democrats either. So, but I am. I am, and I'm true to that. And I think when the NDP wins elections, we win because we focus on the things that people know that we are good at. We focus, if you look at Manitoba, the focus on public health care was all day, every day. Wub always found a way to get back to health care when he was talking about any question. He made sure that it was tied back to health care. And the NDP is the party that brought Canada Medicare and is fighting to expand into pharmacare now and getting some progress for Canadians on that file, including dental care. So I think when we own the issues that we are good at and that brought us to the party in the first place, other people are excited about voting for us too. And when I look at BC, they really focused on affordability. They focused on housing and getting rid of toll roads and toll highways. Like, people trust us to address the issues that matter to them and their family's budget. That's why, you know, I'm really focused on the things that brought me to the party, including healthcare, climate change, and housing.
So on that, I must say, I love your subtle jabs at some of your competitors that I've seen you throw. Like, it's very entertaining. You did mention, I mean, obviously, like, you do have three key items that you want to talk about. Before we get to that, I was just wondering, like, I mean, you've held the deputy premier, you've held minister of health, and now you want to be the leader of the party. Like, when you look back at your time, especially in the Ministry of Health, what would you do differently? Or what could you say about the party during your time as government? Would you do differently that looking back in hindsight, you're like, oh, that just really didn't sit well with me?
I'll start with the health minister role, because there are a number of things I'm very proud of that we did there. If you give me a chance to talk about those, I don't need to talk about them right now. But there are many things we did really well in healthcare that I'm so proud of. Cheryl knows it took me about 6 months to figure out how to stop the privatization of the lab contract that we had. The previous government wanted to privatize labs and give them to an Australian company, Sonic. I now know I can get out of those kinds of contracts much faster. We don't need to spend 6 months figuring out how to implement our values. Then, of course, Jason Kenney did move forward with privatization to Dynalife, and now Danielle Smith had to bail Dina Life out and bring it back under the public umbrella. I wish I would have just moved faster in those first 6 months, that we would have gotten started on building the lab in year one instead of in year three. I thought that the UCP might look at the fact that we had already spent tens of millions of dollars building this lab and that it was evidence-based. We had the Health Quality Council write the report saying that this was the best model to move forward with for lab services. Now we finally have the current government admitting it probably was, although they think they might want to reprivatize it down the road. I'm just going to own some of these things right off the bat and not mess around taking 2 or 3 years to get construction started. The public lab should have been built and operational. We should have made sure that patients were getting timely results for years already now, instead of taking the time to try to build a business case and all this stuff. Like, forget it. I know what I know, and I know public healthcare, and I would move much quicker on some of those issues if I had it to do over again. And hopefully I will in 3 years.
Okay, so I'm going to push a little bit, because I think that you kind of talked about, like, I would move faster, which I think, like, anyone in hindsight would say. What's, like, I'm actually going to ask, what is something, and I don't want you to, like, point to things you did great that the UCP you believe did worse. Like, what's something that Sarah Hoffman, Minister of Health, would look back and actually say, I didn't hit the mark?
As the health minister.
It could, yeah, or as a government that, like, you sat and was like, we were wrong in this. And I wish we didn't do it.
It's probably easier to, well, talk about specifically the way that we communicated around farm worker rights and that legislation. That's probably a very easy one for me to take some ownership over. I know rural Alberta. I grew up in a very small town. We still own the family farm, the land that the farm was on. I know that the way we were communicating about our intentions there was not helpful to us. And we created a lot of alienation between family farms and the roots of the NDP are small farms with labor activists, right? Like unions and farmers working together to build this party. And I want to get back to acknowledging those roots and respectfully communicating about what the values are that bring us along, rather than saying, we know better, we're going to implement all this WCB stuff that people weren't actually asking us for in family farms. Sure, we needed them for the meat packing plants and for the bull auctions and other places that were high risk, but family farms, we did a terrible job communicating that. And I take ownership for the role I played in that.
Okay, so thank you. And Cheryl, I'm not going to ask a question, I promise. It's just like for our listeners to be clear, that was like Bill 6 that you brought in, that was some changes to occupational health and safety. I know I've used it against Cheryl in many of our media panels before on, you know, going after the NDP records. So just to be clear, I mean, and I appreciate you taking ownership over the corrective measures, both, but I just wanted to make sure that that's what exactly you were talking about for our listeners that maybe may not know all this stuff as much as we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, Sarah, because that's something that I've talked about a lot too. Not that I don't believe in what we were trying to achieve there, but man, could we have done a better job at communicating it at the time? And you know, it's easy to say that in hindsight. Moving to a different topic, let's talk about climate change, because a lot of people are backing away from talking about climate change right now, partly because as we see, you know, the top issues for people move around a little, environment has slid down the list a bit, as affordability has become, you know, at crisis levels, as healthcare has become at crisis levels, some other crises have fallen down the list a little bit. But you have decided, as part of your three planks of your campaign, to make environment the focus of one of those. And I will say, I think that this has defined you as a candidate, because I don't think any of your competitors are really leaning into an environmental argument. So maybe just talk about that, why you chose environment, and then we can sort of jump into what your plan to tackle climate change is.
Thank you. As you probably know, I've door knocked hundreds of thousands of doors in this province, both when I ran for the school board and owned that I was a New Democrat, and then as a New Democrat, and as a volunteer on other NDP campaigns. And I will say that every day during the 2023 campaign, somebody brought up the impacts of climate change. They don't always lead with the words climate change, but I was door knocking in May and kids couldn't play outside because the air quality was too bad to let them go out for recess. And parents were bringing this up every day. When I spend time in Northwestern Alberta in particular, people were talking about the go bags they had ready and the fact that they were having to flee their communities, you know, with very little notice. And what do you put in your go bag? in southeastern Alberta, I've spent a lot of time in Medicine Hat. People are talking about catastrophic drought and the fact that their agricultural practices aren't sustainable in the way that they've been in the past because we're so short of water. People are talking about the impacts of climate change. And I know that there were 1,300 votes to be found if we would have offered some real solutions and hope on climate change. I also know that there's a ton of economic opportunity as well. When I launched my climate pillar, one of the pieces included is a Youth Climate Corps, which is an opportunity for young people to take climate change into their own hands, have great jobs, doing things like becoming operating engineers, installing wind turbines, or building berms, operating heavy equipment. There's lots of great jobs, and other jurisdictions are doing this. We're already looking at Biden-Harris south of the border, launching something very similar, and I expect other provinces will be doing the same too, because young people in particular want to take some ownership over this. There's opportunities to have great careers, mortgage paying jobs, and fight climate change by water smarting and fire smarting municipalities. There's lots that we can do to put this in our own control. And I think that most Albertans want solutions. They don't want excuses.
So on that note, sorry, I just want to follow up.
No,
on
go
that
ahead.
Note,
because I asked like four questions. So go.
It's like, I think it's really easy. And I get a little frustrated by this to say we need to take action on climate change and let that stand as your commitment to members or to voters or what, depending on the campaign that you're in. And to me, we need to fight climate change. Just that's, there's not enough there. Yeah. So you've made a point of really sort of fleshing this out. So maybe just take us through how, if you're the leader of the NDP, or if you're the premier of Alberta, how do we fight climate change? And does the carbon tax play a role in that?
Absolutely does. And I was around the table with you, Cheryl, when we landed on the climate leadership plan. And I'll say that the methane reductions absolutely work. Danielle Smith's traveling the world, taking credit for them. Bravo. The phase out of coal has also worked. We don't see anybody saying we need to bring back coal-fired electricity. We know that the TIER model has worked. We've seen lots of revenue generated and some investment in technologies to help reduce emissions. But the consumer-based carbon tax has not worked. It hasn't reduced emissions. It hasn't made people's bills cheaper. And when the federal government took it over and then they decided to exempt the East Coast from having to pay it for their home heating fuels, they completely undermined confidence in it and broke the system. So I've moved beyond the consumer-based carbon tax, and I believe that cap and trade is the best model for us to be able to hold large emitters responsible, make sure that the public money that we have is invested in making life more affordable for people in the public and reducing their emissions. One of the big reasons why we haven't seen big uptake in EVs is because it's still so incredibly expensive. And in fact, in this last budget, a new tax was added, $200 a year for having an EV, as opposed to other jurisdictions that have seen lots of moving towards EVs have invested in rebates up front. So making it cheaper for you to buy one, which also reduces your bills down the road and reduces emissions. So it's, you know, win-win-win if we actually put that investment, that public money into reducing emissions for members of the public.
So I think like that all sounds great. First on the EV tax, I mean, they're not really paying the same tax other people that are using roads are currently paying. So, and they've also proven that they go through tires faster. I don't know if I agree with you on the EV tax not making it affordable. It's $200 when an EV costs like $60,000. But when it comes to like this carbon tax, you have close allegiance to Rachel Notley. There was the Trudeau Notley Alliance. Where are you going to sit with like this federal carbon tax? And would you put one in place in Alberta should you become premier?
No, I want cap and trade. I think that makes so much more sense. And I think we can meet our national and international obligations under a cap and trade model and show leadership without tying ourselves to a model that's been broken by the federal government. I believe that Albertans want to take leadership on this, and we should do it as Albertans. We don't need to lean on somebody else. We have lots of expertise here. I've done lots of consultation. I'm really proud of the plan that we came up with. And I'm not keen on carrying water for the federal government in this. I want to make sure that we get water to municipalities that need it. That's my goal. And, industry's been very successful pulling carbon out of the earth. They can also pull it out of the atmosphere, and we can hold them accountable for that.
And how are you going to do that? You talked about like balancing that and affordability. Again, like I said, it sounds good, but what are the tangible things that you would do to balance that beyond, like you said, using public money to support? Like, but if there is no public money, how do you do that without running a huge deficit like we saw last time?
Well, there is public money because I'm going to hold polluters responsible if they don't meet their cap and trade obligations. Then they pay the tax, right? And then that money that comes in is public money. So then we can use that to reduce consumers' bills. We can use it to put solar on every home that wants it. We can get rid of the, like, here's another thing. For people who are all big fans of the free market, there is a cap on how much solar you can put on your home, and it's tied to how much energy you use right now. That's ridiculous. If people want to put more modules on their roof and feed more into the system, why wouldn't we allow that for their farm or for their house? So there's lots of ways that we can incent through upfront grants, people reducing their emissions and putting more energy on the grid. And we're going to hold the polluter pay principle as a very high priority for me. And if you're not meeting your obligations and reducing emissions and you're paying into that large industrial emitter rate, then that money should be used to help regular people reduce their bills. We shouldn't be focusing all of that money on giving it back to industry. We should be focusing on, okay, these are your obligations, meet those reductions. And if you don't, you'll pay that tax. And then that tax will be used to help the rest of us reduce our emissions.
Just pivoting a little bit, I wanted to ask you a question because I think, you know, we've lost two elections in a row now. There's lots of people, you know, taking a look at what we've done well and what we've done poorly and where we need to pivot a little bit to be successful in the next election. And I think there is some consensus that we need to grow in spaces outside of Calgary and Edmonton. We need to grow the party. We need to pick up seats outside those two major cities. So if you're the leader of the NDP, how will you do that?
And I'm trying to model it through this leadership race. And honestly, like, Cheryl, you've known me, like, I have been on the road for 8 years. I think that the best way to build the party is to get out and connect with those community leaders in their communities and engage them in doing that work between visits of the leader. But one of the best things we learned in this last 4 years is, like, Rachel consistently showed up for Calgary. A lot of us were down there door knocking. I spent a lot of time recruiting Calgary candidates and helping them fundraise. We ran a great campaign in Calgary by showing up and focusing on it. And it worked. We won the popular vote. We won the majority of the seats. And we can do that in other places across Alberta too. I worked a lot with Banff Kananaskis. Most of it was during the pandemic. So I was sitting here on my computer calling in and doing volunteer recruitment, retention, and fundraising with them and with their local volunteers that they already had. And guess what? We won Banff Kananaskis. And we can win in other seats right across Alberta too, but we have to show up. And that's part of why I lead my video by talking about my roots in Canuso. It's not okay with me that Canuso has a UCP MLA. So I want to make sure that changes.
Shockingly, I'm okay with that. What I was going to ask, what I was going to say is, you know, you talk about, like, what I'm hearing from you is you want to be a leader that's, you know, all four corners, or you're taking all three strategy. It's not the Ralph Klein, like, two of three Calgary and Edmonton, which I think is a different strategy is from what I've seen from the NDP. If that's the case, who do you think your competition is in this race?
Danielle Smith. Like,
well, okay, good. Good answer. I'll give you
that
credit
for that.
That is
a great answer.
One. It is. I was like, damn, how do I push back on this one? But in your NDP leadership race, like, you've been coined the front runner by some. Nahed has been deemed the front runner. We talked about, you know, that we see, like, some people, that group, including Ganley, being, you know, in that they can possibly win, like you, Ganley and Nahed. Who do you see as the person you have to beat besides Danielle Smith? In the NDP leadership, to be clear.
Way to clarify. And now I have to give you an actual answer you want. You know, if I had to guess who's going to be on the final ballot, I think it'll be a Hofshi ballot. I think it's going to be Nenshi and Hoff. And I think I'm going to win. And part of why I think I'm going to win is because when I launched here in Edmonton with hundreds of people, hundreds of volunteers in the room, it was really exciting to be with. No, I got into politics because I wanted to do more with more and create more change. And that's what this campaign is about for me. So we launched here with hundreds of people, hit the highway, hit Calgary, Medicine Hat, Lethbridge, Red Deer, then up to Grand Prairie, Fairview, Grimshaw, Valley View, Peace River. Like, that's what I want to do. And I want ambassadors all over the province helping do this work in between visits. But I want to be the kind of leader who's on the road, who's accessible, and who's engaging with the members. And I know that when we show up, we win. We saw that in Calgary, and we can do it again in Calgary, in Edmonton, and in other parts of the province too.
Sarah, we know your time is tight and you have many places to be. We'll just wrap up with a couple last questions that we've asked your competitors in the race. If you are successful, what does day one look like for you as leader of the NDP, and what do the next 3 years look like?
Oh, I was thinking about day one as premier. Can I answer that question first?
Sure.
Sure.
Repealing the
I like your optimism.
Yeah. Repealing the ban on wind and solar, that is like probably job number one. It has major economic impacts and environmental impacts, and we have an opportunity to have great investment in that area. Day one as NDP leader is probably pulling the team together and calling a bunch of key stakeholders who maybe weren't on my team, making sure that they know that they've got a path. I know, Erica, like you worked on a leadership campaign that wasn't successful, but then you supported the next leader in a really profound way. And that's what I want to do. I want to pull everyone together. Right now, we're all fighting our own thing. I get it. But on June 23rd, I want us to make sure that we're all focused on the next 3 years and what we need to do together to win. And I want people to know that there's a spot for them in a Sarah Hoffman leadership and a Sarah Hoffman cabinet.
All right. And so Cheryl gets to ask the optimistic that you win scenario. I have to ask the negative one. So you don't win. You're a sitting MLA. You've held many leadership roles under the previous leader. Do you run again? Like, what does Sarah Hoffman's future look like should you not become leader?
I'm going to be a little tricky on this one and say that, like, I've run in 5 elections in a row and I've won and a contested nomination. Like, I ran for school board twice in a row. People thought I couldn't win there. I was running against an incumbent. We won. We got 70% of the vote. I ran again and I won again. I ran for MLA against Heather Klimchuk, very popular conservative cabinet minister, won with 70% of the vote, won the next 2 elections as well. Like, I am in this to win this. And that is all of my energy right now. Erica is focused on my strategy to make sure that we have the path to victory and that I get to be the next leader and then the next premier. So if that isn't the case, I'll answer your question then, but I'm planning on winning.
Well, I'll hold you to that if that is the case, but I do also, you come out with a bang and I'll let you leave on a bang. So that's it. That is our show today, folks. Thank you so much, Sarah, for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today. And as you guys know, all of our episodes drop Thursday morning at 5 a.m.
Follow and subscribe on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
The Discourse is hosted by Cheryl Oates and Erica Baroudes. Follow on Instagram at The Discourse Pod. Subscribe to The Discourse on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.